I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Fast and Furious was a sting operation run by the ATF office in Phoenix, Arizona, beginning in 2009. It let straw purchasers buy assault weapons with the idea that the guns could be traced when taken across the border and used by drug cartels. The program went seriously wrong when agents lost track of an estimated 2,000 guns. Some were used in violent crimes in Mexico, and two were found near where Border Patrol agent Brian Terry was killed in December 2010. Fast and Furious is now at the center of a fight between the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, headed up by Daryl Issa, and Attorney General Eric Holder. The committee voted to hold Holder in contempt of Congress for refusing to hand over documents. The full House could vote this week. Holder has appeared before the committee a number of times and given them thousands of pages of documents. President Obama invoked executive privilege last week, backing up the Attorney General. Well, here to make sense of all of this is Major Garrett. He's the White House correspondent for the National Journal, joins us from the studios of Atlantic Media. And Major Garrett, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It is great to be with you.
Let me just put some basic facts on the table and ask you about this Fast and Furious program. How similar is it, or was it, because it has been stopped, to a gun walking operation that was done or used under the Bush administration?
That had a different name. It was called Operation Wide Receiver, and it grew out of something called Operation Gunrunner, which started about 2005 with the Bush administration. So the one fact that's worth pointing out in this entire saga is that in two different administrations, the Bush administration and the Obama administration, the issue of guns sold in America crossing the border and contributing to violence in Mexico or arming increasingly aggressive and violent drug cartels has been a bipartisan concern and a governmental concern for the better part of 7 years. Operation Gunrunner led to Operation Wide Receiver, both in the Bush administration. Both did not work out very well. There was a tremendous, and there have been Inspector General reports on this, terrible communication between the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Justice Department, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency Administration. One of the problems that in those Bush administration programs was they didn't communicate with each other very well. They didn't talk about ongoing investigations. Sometimes they would sell firearms, and then they would want to arrest the purchaser, and the other agency would say, hey, wait a minute, don't arrest that person. He's an informant for us. And so those programs did not work out well. Operation Wide Receiver had some prosecutions and some low-level, meaning low-quantity, gun walking. Fast and Furious is different in kind and different in scope. It was started by the Obama administration in early 2009, and the overall idea behind it was, let's sell a lot of firearms, trace them as best we can, and get the biggest actors in Mexico at the drug cartel level who are purchasing these firearms, because that's the goal. Not just to monitor the movement of these weapons, but to get them all the way up the chain. So the biggest and baddest, if you will, gun runners and drug traffickers in Mexico could be prosecuted successfully. That was the goal. It fell far, far short of that goal by Justice Department acknowledgement.
Was anyone in Mexico, any one of these traffickers or gun runners, drug traffickers, were they ever prosecuted under this program?
No. No, there were indictments brought, and they were unsuccessful. There were some straw purchasers, much as there had been in the Bush administration, low-level, a straw purchaser just in the nomenclature for people to understand and keep track of. A straw purchaser is someone who goes in and buys the firearms. And what kind of firearms are we talking about? We're not talking about handguns. We're talking about AK-47 or AK-47-type long rifle variants. These are very lethal weapons, extremely lethal, powerful, multi-magazine clips. They're bad, bad weapons. Right. So the straw purchaser comes in, and remember, they go to a dealer that is cooperating with the government. Okay? They're saying, all right, you want me to sell these firearms, right? And the Justice Department, or in this case, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, says, yes, go ahead and sell them. I mean, they're not right there whispering in their ear, but it's all understood. The straw purchaser walks out of the firearms seller, the gun shop, and moves on down the road. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that the government would be able to track the movement of those weapons, follow them not only while they moved through the United States, but across the border and then into the lair, if you will, of the drug traffickers. That ever happened. And we don't even have a fixed number. I've seen 2,000, 1,700, 1,600, 1,400 as far as the number of firearms that walked. I don't know what the actual reliable number is. I don't think the government has an exact number on that either. It's in that range. Two of those firearms, so far as all the reporting I've seen on it, had little GPS devices that could actually physically track the whereabouts of that firearm. The rest were supposed to be sort of tracked by other means. They weren't. They're still lost, meaning they're still out there. And at that level, the Justice Department readily admits, look, this was a big failure.
And it seems that the murder, frankly, of Brian Terry, a Border Patrol agent, he was killed December 2010. Now, two of these guns were found near where he was killed, but that seems...
At the scene.
And it seems like his death then has led to the investigation and the various questions about this program. And I have to say, in reading, in preparation for the show, it's always described as a botched operation.
Yes. And the reason we are at this point of a conflict between the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee and the Justice Department is, for a good long while, the Justice Department, when questioned by Congress about this, said Fast and Furious was not a gun-walking operation. They denied that for quite some time. As a matter of fact, there is a very disputed piece of paperwork submitted to a congressional committee, in this case Government Reform and Oversight, back in February of 2011. That'd be 3 months after Brian Terry's murder, saying this was not a gun walking operation. Why are you even using those phrases? 10 months later, the Justice Department retracts that submission to Congress and says, yes, it was a gun walking operation, an unsuccessful gun walking operation. And what Congress is trying to find out right now, so it says, Chairman Issa is the one who's behind all this, says they want to know why Congress was misled in February of 2011. Why, after 3 months, the Justice Department couldn't, from the Republicans' point of view, fess up and admit that it was a gun-walking operation. There had already been whistleblowers who had contacted Congress and said, this is a gun-walking operation and you need to look into it. Why was it denied? Why did it take 10 months to correct the record? And was there any effort within Justice in those intervening 10 months to either intimidate or punish or in somehow lean on whistleblowers or create some sort of atmosphere within the various agencies involved that this was not to be discussed, not to be talked about? That's really what this contempt resolution, this executive privilege conflict is about.
Well, let me just quote just a couple of half sentences from that February 4th letter. This is the Justice Department said the ATF, quote, never knowingly allowed the sale of assault weapons to a straw purchaser who then transported them to Mexico. The ATF also said, quote, every effort to interdict weapons that have been purchased illegally and prevent their transportation into Mexico. Every effort to they were making every effort they could to prevent the transportation into Mexico. I'm sort of botching what that letter said. But
that's the general spirit of it, yes.
Exactly. But nonetheless, and this letter essentially sort of stood until about 10 months later when the Justice Department said that was mistaken information.
Correct. Mistaken information. And by this time, Congress felt very confident that congressional investigators, both for Senator Charles Grassley, who's a Republican from Iowa, who was on an oversight committee in the Senate, but because he's not the chairman of that committee, he doesn't have subpoena power. And one interesting aspect of this story, Marty, is that the first lawmaker to raise questions about this was Senator Grassley. Whistleblowers went to Senator Grassley. He has a longstanding reputation in Washington as someone who takes whistleblowers seriously and who tries to hold the government to account on a lot of various oversight issues. And most people regard him, though he's a Republican and though he has his partisan tendencies at times, in the area of oversight and sort of holding government accountable, he's regarded as a pretty straight shooter. So these whistleblowers came to Senator Grassley. He made initial inquiries, and the Justice Department said to Senator Grassley, we're not going to answer, and we don't have to answer because you don't have subpoena power. So he said, okay, I better give it to somebody who does. Well, that would be Chairman Issa of the Government Reform and Oversight Committee, because he has the committee, the chairmanship, and the numbers on that committee to vote for subpoenas, which they did. And so that was the process of trying to unearth or extract from the Justice Department what it knew and what it was willing to tell the public about Fast and Furious. And I think this whole story and how we got to the place where we are now is the Justice Department initially was very not only hesitant but reluctant to cooperate with these congressional investigators. And both sides right now, to use kind of a hackneyed metaphor, have their back up. Both sides are a little intimidated with each other, and they're angry with each other, and they're not communicating. I don't want to make this sound like a psychodrama or something, but sometimes politics operates on this level.
Indeed.
Congress believes it has its duty bound to investigate this. The Justice Department thinks it's making a terrible situation, Brian Terry's murder, this botched program, into something much larger and much more grand for purely political theatrical reasons, and both sides question deeply the other's motives. And that's, I think, one of the backstories here.
And but what you hear from the Justice Department and from Holder himself is that they have turned over, 7,600 pages of documents, or 7,600 documents, and then Holder has testified before Congress about Fast and Furious something like 9 times, saying that we have given you the information that you have been looking for.
True. That is one of the Justice Department reactions. And in every congressional investigation, and I've covered many and I've read about many, many administrations of both parties like to quote numbers and pages.
Right.
Numbers and pages are relevant only if the information is responsive to the request. And the position of the Government Reform and Oversight Committee is they're not responsive to our request. Yes, you're giving us pages. In many cases, they're redacted. They're incomplete or insufficient information, and they're not what we've actually asked for. And that tension point is something that runs through congressional investigations dealing with the Environmental Protection Agency during the Reagan administration. It deals with other aspects of investigations Congress held of the Clinton administration, George W. Bush's administration. There was most recently, the last time we sort of got in this contempt area, Congress and the administration, was over the firing of U.S. attorneys by the Bush administration the second term. The Bush administration back then handed over a lot of pages of information, too, and the congressional committee said, yeah, lots of pages, not what we asked for. So you can send us more and more pages, truckloads if you want, but until we get what we've actually asked for, we're going to continue to keep the pressure on. And that's been the reaction from the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee.
About a minute before our first break here, but how many times has Congress, now this is the committee, voted in support of contempt of Congress against Attorney General Eric Holder. How often has that happened?
3 times an Attorney General at the committee level in our history has been held in contempt. Never has the full House voted to hold an Attorney General in contempt. So it would be a bigger deal. It would be a very big deal. And yesterday, Chairman Issa, on 3 different shows, right, Sunday shows, he was making the rounds. That's also something that sort of irritates Democrats. They think Chairman Issa really enjoys, to an extravagant degree, the publicity this has generated. Said if we get or have a dialogue about these documents, we will delay and possibly cancel the contempt citation. So I still think there's a chance to work this out.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Major Garrett. He's the White House correspondent for the National Journal. We asked him to join us in this first portion of Radio Times today to talk about some of the facts and some of the politics of Fast and Furious. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I do want to talk more about Darrell Issa after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Wistar Institute supports WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. The newest cancer treatments almost always start with a breakthrough in basic science research. Wistar researchers identify the causes of cancer, and this can lead to treatments that directly target the causes without the harmful side effects of older cancer therapies. Basic research saves lives and needs your support. To learn more about how you can join us and help save lives, visit wistar.org.
Hi, this is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. This year, WHYY celebrated the first anniversary of Newsworks Tonight and the 25th anniversaries of Fresh Air and Radio Times. WHYY's fiscal year ends this Saturday, June 30th. As we prepare for the next fiscal year and beyond, I hope you'll consider making a donation at whyy.org or by calling us at 1-888-345-9499. Thanks.
Each year, tens of thousands of new albums are released, and sifting through all that music is a difficult task for any music fan. But fear not, Sound Opinions is here to help. I'm Greg Kotz.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. We've hit the mid-year point, which means it's time for the best albums of 2012 so far. That's this week on Sound Opinions.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. President Obama invoked executive privilege last Wednesday for the first time. He was shielding Attorney General Eric Holder, who has refused to release certain documents to a congressional committee that is investigating the failed gun smuggling operation known as Fast and Furious. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which is chaired by Daryl Issa, took an unusual step last week to hold Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. We're talking about all of this with Major Garrett, the White House correspondent for the National Journal, and taking calls, any questions or comments you might have at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Major, let me ask you just a couple of questions about Daryl Issa, and he is quoted as saying that Obama, quote, one of the most corrupt presidents in modern times. Why did he say that, and what does that say about Daryl Issa?
Well, he said that in a very broad and generalized context, almost as soon as I can't remember the exact date, Marty, but it was very soon after taking control of the Committee on Government Reform and Oversight. And he almost immediately within the week or two after that statement, tried to walk it back, dial it back, as we say here in Washington, D.C. But he said it, and he said it in a very intense partisan context, and that Democrats suspect, and they believe they have solid foundation based on Daryl Issa's own words, to believe that he judges before he assembles data to back up a judgment, and that he became convinced early on that Fast and Furious was a cover-up, and therefore intensified his curiosity about Fast and Furious. I would say, however, that the Justice Department, by not dealing with Senator Grassley, demanding subpoenas from the committee, and then filing to Congress's official piece of paperwork. I mean, it wasn't just someone picked up a phone and said, hey, what are we doing on Fast and Furious? Is that a gun? No, we don't think so. Bye-bye. You know, it was a formal submission to Congress in response to formal questions. Those things are supposed to have and should have core validity, and they didn't. And it took 10 months to recorrect the record. So Daryl Issa may have partisan instincts here. Democrats may consider him someone who looks before he leaps and charges before he's assembled a case. But there are certain elements of this record that have been corrected by the Justice Department much later than would have been satisfactory to Daryl Issa. And now you have an assertion of executive privilege where for months and months and months, the White House, whenever queried about this story, said, we don't have anything to do with this. Why are you even asking us? This isn't part of our world. It's a Justice Department thing. Go talk to the Justice Department. Well, now, an executive privilege assertion can only come with involvement by the White House, and that's part of what the White House is saying, that there is conversations now between the White House and Justice that must be protected. And one thing that needs to happen for that to be properly evaluated, either by the committee or a court if it gets there, is the White House needs to provide what's called an executive privilege log, an exact logging of the pages or the documents or the conversations described generally so they can be evaluated as to whether they fit under the Supreme Court's definition, which I understand has been evolving and is somewhat flexible, but there is still a precedential understanding of what executive privilege means. You have to say what you're covering with your executive privilege assertion. You simply can't say, well, there was lots of conversations and they're all protected.
You have to actually provide some evidence that there were some kind of conversations, even if you don't tell them about the content of the conversations.
Yes, right. You don't reveal content, but you say, for example, this was a pre-decision conversation about this aspect of this government program involving this structured part of the White House and this structured part of the Justice Department, and because they're pre-decision and about the government deciding among itself and debating itself, they're protected. Okay, fine. Right. But you at least have to assert what it was about.
Let me ask you something else that Daryl Issa actually said to an NRA convention, and I'm quoting here, and this plays into some conspiracy theories about Fast and Furious, that it's an effort to try to take assault weapons away from Americans. But here's what Daryl Issa said. Could it be that what they were really thinking of was, in fact, to use this walking of guns in order to promote an assault weapons ban? Many think so, and they haven't come up with an explanation information that would cause us not to agree. Sounds like a statement embedded in a question, but that does play into some, I guess they're conspiracy theories. It's hard to imagine. But how do you understand what he was saying to the NRA?
Well, this has been, in the eyes of some Republicans, a proxy fight with the Obama administration about gun control. Now, there are many in the gun control community who believe the Obama administration has done nothing on gun control and ought to do much more. So there is no evidence on the ground, politically or legislatively, that the Obama administration has taken on gun control at any visible level. And yesterday, Jake Tapper on ABC's This Week, I think, did a very good job of precisely asking Chairman Issa, do you believe this is about gun control? And what Chairman Issa said on ABC yesterday was fundamentally different than he said at that NRA convention, which was, he said, we may never know. Okay.
Chicken or egg, I think he said.
Yes,
right?
Chicken or egg. And we may never know, and I'm not alleging that. Okay, so it sounded to me as if he is completely backing off that even veiled assertion that this was about gun control. As I said, the Bush administration was concerned about this issue. It is a legitimate issue. Mm-hmm. And there is a policy dispute about how many firearms are sold in the United States actually end up in Mexico and become armaments for these drug gangs. And look, drug gang activity in Mexico is a serious, serious issue. 150 people, according to a government official in Mexico, quoted by the Los Angeles Times, have been killed in Mexico by guns that walked in Fast and Furious. That's a lot of people. But think about the thousands upon thousands. I'm not even sure, Marty, what the actual number is now, but it's above 30,000 have been killed in Mexico as a result of either the crossfire or planned reprisal killings between the drug factions, the drug gangs in Mexico. It's a serious issue. The Bush administration tried and dealt with it unsuccessfully. The Obama administration tried unsuccessfully. There is an American Border Patrol agent and an aggrieved family, Brian Terry and his survivors, who want more answers. So this is a serious issue. The government has tried to deal with it, and its success ratio is pretty, pretty limited.
Let me ask you something else that Darrell Issa seemed to say yesterday on some of the talk shows on Sunday. I asked, actually, on Fox News Sunday, he was asked by Chris Wallace whether he had any evidence that the White House had been involved with Fast and Furious. Darrell Issa said, no, we don't. What's the significance of that?
Well, I don't think that Darrell Issa ever imagined that the White House or the President was directly involved in Fast and Furious, but what he wanted to know was, and what he still would like to know is, did the White House have more knowledge about the evolution of Fast and Furious than it has publicly represented? And that would be along the lines of holding those who signed off on Fast and Furious accountable, not only in the public eye, but possibly in a larger sense. Meaning if you signed off on this program and it was a spectacular failure, maybe you should lose your job in government. Darrell Issa hasn't called for anyone to resign, although Republicans have said Eric Holder should resign as Attorney General. But on the accountability side, the Republican-led House Oversight and Reform Committee would like to know who signed off on this. How high did it go up, and how high was that knowledge? And one other thing. What's come out in the course of the investigation after the Justice Department saying this was a low-level thing done by the field agents with some general sign-off in Washington? Well, several wiretaps were approved for Fast and Furious. Wiretaps have to be approved at the highest levels of the criminal division within the Justice Department. It's now been verified, and the documents have been released, that those wiretaps were, in fact, taken to the highest levels of the criminal division of the Justice Department and approved. Okay, that's new information. That does also conflict with the Justice Department's earliest representations, which were this wasn't at the highest levels. So somebody at the high level was involved in this program, and they would like to know who and why.
Well, and even going back, and this gets us a bit into the weeds, but there are a lot of weeds associated with this
story.
There are. But John Boehner said last week that because the president invoked executive privilege, quote, it was an admission that the White House was involved in decisions that misled Congress and covered up the truth. And so there seems to be some conflict between Darrell Issa and House Speaker John Boehner on the White House involvement.
Okay, let's separate the weed patch since we're deep into it, okay?
Yes.
There is one set of weeds. Did the White House approve and conjure up Fast and Furious? As the White House, okay? That's an operational question. There's no evidence that operationally the White House conceived of, enlarged Fast and Furious, made it a big thing, and the president said, by God, we're going to do that. There's no evidence of that. But what John Boehner was referring to was, did the White House, in consultation with the Justice Department, in a way to continue to keep Congress from poking its nose into Fast and Furious, have anything to do with that original February 2011 submission that said and that declared letter. Emphatically this was not a gun-walking operation? Okay, that's so those are the two separate weed patches. One is operational, and one is, was there communication between the White House and the White House say, you know, just tell them, put something together that says it wasn't a gun-walking operation. Get them off our backs. That would be a different in kind. It's not operational. It's not a decision point for the president. Go do Fast and Furious. Make sure all this thing gets carried out under my name. That's one operational question. The other one is, okay, they're asking about it. What should we do? Well, tell them it wasn't a gun-walking operation, and that if the White House was involved with that, and then the White House has to retract, as the Justice Department does, Speaker Boehner says that might constitute a cover-up. And the public will decide, of course, whether it's a cover-up or whether it was a miscommunication or just the government screwing up something that it had already screwed up in the first place.
Well, we are talking about Fast and Furious today on Radio Times with Major Garrett. He's the White House correspondent for the National Journal, and we'll be joined by a constitutional law professor in about 10 minutes or so, Michael Gerhardt. We'd love to hear from you, any questions or comments that you might have about this fast-evolving story. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I need to quote something else, but I'm embarrassed to say I don't know where I got this because I forgot to print out where I read this. But nonetheless, the quote says, the House, and this would be the House of Representatives, twice has voted to block continued implementation of the administration's regulatory requirement that multiple sales of semi-automatic rifles in the border states be promptly reported to ATF to give the law enforcers real-time notice of the suspicious gun sales that are feeding the cartels. This is about the fact that there are these guns, not through Fast and Furious, that have ended up in Mexico, many of them used in the commission of crimes. And the question is whether the House really wants to control and keep track of guns beyond Fast and Furious going across the border into Mexico.
A much larger question. And outside of Fast and Furious, that is a substantial policy disagreement. Republicans, generally speaking, have no intention of changing anything in the present American legal framework about the sale of firearms through licensed and regulated firearms dealers. And they don't want any more restrictions. They don't want anything else to be done. And in some cases, there are some proposals to loosen things and make them more available. That is a larger issue. Mm-hmm. And as I think one of my colleagues at the Atlantic Media pointed out on Friday on the Atlantic Wire website, we're talking about far greater numbers of sales of weapons that are legal, not traced, anything like else that may, in fact, be getting over the border and fueling violence perpetrated by these Mexican drug gangs. And as sometimes happens in Washington, you can have a big constitutional or procedural or political dispute over one small thing. Meanwhile, the big, larger issue all around it, the sort of elephant in the room, gets blithely ignored. And in the case of firearms sold in this country that get across the border, that is a bigger issue. And it is not being addressed in the debate over Fast and Furious, over a contempt citation, or anything else involving Eric Holder or Daryl Issa.
Now, where does this story go from here? Now, we have this showdown, and I'm assuming there are meetings, or at least discussions about meetings this week to try to resolve this issue?
There are no meetings scheduled, but that doesn't mean meetings won't occur. As of this morning, Chairman Issa is developing a letter that he has had legal scholars work with him on to be very precise in his request and to sort of refine again his request for certain documents. And his body language and the words he expressed yesterday, even though he used cover-up and you can't use liar's poker and you've got to be responsive, he also said, look, if we can get to these documents that we've asked and they're responsive, then we will delay or cancel the contempt vote. I still think this can be resolved if both sides come down a little bit off of their current pedestals. And that often happens. Janet Reno was held in contempt by a Republican-led congressional committee. Mm-hmm. That never went to the floor. Things were resolved. Harriet Myers and Karl Rove working for President George W. Bush were held in contempt. There was not a floor vote on that either. These things move through committee and ratchet up pressure and create an imagery and an intensification of these institutional pressures in Washington, and sometimes that alone can bring people to the table and create a space to compromise within.
Even this particular Congress, which certainly has a history of drawing a line in the sand over a whole host of important issues.
I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying it's possible. And there were things about the way Chairman Issa comported himself yesterday on television that this is all pure hunch on my part, and in communicating with the people who were closest to him, they do not seem as intense about this or as gleeful about the confrontation as they did a couple of weeks ago. If the chairman believes net-net he's made his point, got to the documents, they might be able to resolve this. But the current schedule is contempt vote Wednesday or Thursday on the floor of the House, and if it's brought, it will pass because Republicans will vote for it. And some Democrats might even vote for it too, although I don't know if that's true or not. I haven't done a whip count. I don't know where people are on this. Chairman Issa seems to think Democrats will vote for it. I don't know.
It'll pass because we're talking about a Republican majority in the House. That simple.
Right.
But
and remember, one of the two things quickly.
Sure.
There's an Inspector General's investigation being conducted by the Justice Department, which is an outside force looking in this. That report will be due in the next month or two. Within the last month or so, the Department of Homeland Security opened up a separate Inspector General investigation into this. So there will be other means by which this program and where it went wrong and why will be dissected and presented to the American public, because Inspectors General are independent. They have full authority to go in and ferret out and find things. And generally speaking, in Washington, they go where the facts lead them without fear or favor. And so the last word will not be whatever Daryl Issa and the Attorney General negotiate.
Well, again, about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, this sounds like it's going to be a very busy week in Washington with this case and, of course, waiting for whatever the Supreme Court decides on several important issues.
And I said on Washington Week on Friday on PBS that one of the ways you can understand and internalize how much the House Republican leadership is eager to do this is that they schedule this in such a way that not only will this be wedged between and possibly drowned out by the health care decision, the immigration decision, but this week's also going to be a decision point on a big two-year transportation bill and the fate of student loan interest rates. All those things could come clamoring down to the floor of the House of Representatives this week, and fast and furious, highly topical next week, may be voted on or may be resolved, but it may fall to a lower level or a lower rung on the news ladder. And I think one of the things that tells you is the House leadership is willing to do this, but it's scheduled in a way where it's not going to be the lead item all week long.
Well, as always, Major Garrett, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Major Garrett is a White House correspondent for the National Journal, joined us to talk about some of the politics associated with Fast and Furious. We have a law professor waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about contempt of Congress, executive privilege, and the separation of powers. Stay with us. Call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies offers professional master's degrees that teach students the critical skills for emerging professions in the natural and social sciences. Degrees in environmental sciences, medical physics, applied positive psychology, applied geosciences, and the liberal arts draw on Penn's research specialties. Part-time options and evening classes for some degrees are designed to fit the needs of working professionals. Details online by searching Penn LPS, a proud supporter of WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Alec Baldwin. He's starring in two new films. He's a long-haired club owner in Rock of Ages, the big-screen adaptation of the Broadway musical. He also stars in the new Woody Allen comedy, To Rome with Love. And, of course, he's best known for his role as Jack Donaghy on the hit NBC series 30 Rock. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Poetry can give shape and voice to our darkest feelings of suffering. Research shows writing about difficult moments can be an extraordinarily freeing experience, leading to a sense of safety, renewed energy, and restored order. On the next Voices in the Family, Dan Gottlieb talks with author and teacher Ellen Bass about poetry as a tool for healing. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. The House of Representatives is scheduled to vote on whether to hold Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. And at issue are some documents about a botched ATF sting operation that Holder is refusing to hand over. He has the backing and support of the White House when President Obama invoked executive privilege for the first time last week. Well, joining us now is Michael Gerhardt. He's the Samuel Ashe Distinguished Professor in Constitutional Law, also Director of the Center for Law and Government at the University of North Carolina Law School. And Michael Gerhardt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm not sure whether to begin with contempt of Congress or executive privilege, but let's start with executive privilege first. The president did invoke it the last week for the first time. Where does a president or any president get the power to use executive privilege?
Well, he is not the first president to do this. Of course, every president does it, and every president believes they've got this authority, and I think it's pretty much well settled that a president has the authority to be able to invoke executive privilege based on his need to maintain the confidentiality of certain information that's been generated on his behalf. And so, for example, the Supreme Court even recognized that there's what's called a qualified executive privilege in the famous Watergate tapes case, saying that a president could invoke a generalized need to maintain confidentiality for information in that case, where President Nixon was trying to say that he didn't have to turn information over to the courts that pertained to his involvement in the Watergate break-in. It turned out that courts forced him to do that because they found that there was a greater need for disclosure in that case because of the defendant's right to have information presented in their criminal trials. But here, this is a contest between the president and Congress, and obviously the president thinks that there's some information related to this affair that was that just simply cuts too close to the White House's need to maintain confidentiality to ensure candid discourse about issues relating to his power.
Well, but I also wonder, and there are, of course, many things we don't know when it comes to this particular case, but it does involve the Justice Department. Eric Holder, as I understand it, in a sense, sort of asked the president to invoke executive privilege.
Yes.
Does that raise any questions for you?
Not necessarily. I mean, it is somewhat unusual for executive privilege to extend beyond the strict confines of the White House, you know, the president and his closest advisors. But there's some situations in which there are people in the executive branch, and obviously the Attorney General works in the executive branch, who are producing information either at the president's request or information that pertains to the president's power or information that the president needs essentially to sort of do his job. So the president's argument here would be that there's some information relating to this affair that was produced either on his behalf or at his direction. And in that kind of circumstance, you can invoke executive privilege.
But is the Justice Department, even the Attorney General, while they do work in the executive branch, my understanding is the Attorney General works for the American people?
Well, strictly speaking, he is what's called an officer of the United States, which means he's nominated by the president and he's confirmed by the Senate, but the president can discharge him at any time for any reason. So he is an executive branch officer, which means he's directly under the control of the president. And that would be true for any cabinet secretary. It's true for the Attorney General as well.
Now, Congress's role is oversight. I mean, that's in
right.
part what they do. And if there is this particular kind of showdown between Congress looking to investigate something, in this case, this Fast and Furious operation, and a president exerting executive privilege, is there a compromise here?
There almost always is when it comes to this kind of situation where members of Congress on a committee want some information and the president or somebody who works for the president says this is covered by this special doctrine known as executive privilege. And this kind of situation arises quite frequently, and almost always, they're 99.9% of the time, their accommodations reach between the branches over what information gets disclosed and how it's disclosed.
So the idea is that maybe in this case, Darrell Issay or some other bipartisan members of his committee might sit down with members of the Justice Department and share information or share documents?
Well, there's probably going to be somebody from the White House for that meeting as well, probably the White House counsel or someone like that. And they'll talk about the information that is not covered by privilege that the Attorney General is willing to turn over. And then they'll talk about the specific documents where they're claiming privilege. And then they'll reach some accommodation. That's typically what happens.
Now, this congressional committee invoked their contempt of Congress against Attorney General Eric Holder. How unusual is that?
That's pretty unusual. It's unusual generally to use contempt of Congress. It's not unprecedented. I mean, historically, there have been situations where contempt of Congress has been approved by the entire House or the Senate. But it's fairly rare, in fact, very, very rare when you're talking about a cabinet secretary and virtually unprecedented when you're talking about an attorney general. So this is really a power that can be invoked sort of as a last resort. And so it's a serious power when it is invoked by Congress and carries with it the force, or sometimes can carry with it the force of criminal law.
Meaning what? I mean, if the House were to vote, and there's a Republican majority, so if it goes before the House, chances are it would pass.
Right.
What would happen to Eric Holder?
So there are different situations, but it sounds like in this particular situation, if the House approves the contempt of Congress that the committee wants it to approve,
right,
that would then be sent over to the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia to investigate for criminal action. And that might mean bringing charges against the Attorney General for perjury or other things, whatever criminal misconduct they think he might be guilty of. And so that could result in some kind of criminal action against the Attorney General, but that itself would be unprecedented.
Well, and the U.S. Attorney's Office is under the Justice Department,
right?
Just to complicate things even further.
Yes, and those people, strictly speaking, are under the direction not just of the Attorney General but the President.
Right.
So the structure of this gets rather complicated, which is just another reason why one of the most important things to watch is the extent to which this is actually a very complicated negotiation between the members of the House and the President. To some extent, what you're seeing, I think, is how each side is trying to up the ante in an effort to gain bargaining position or leverage in their negotiation over these documents.
This is one scenario that I read about, that if the House were to approve this, that Eric Holder would be in the position of investigating Eric Holder.
Yes. Now, that's not unprecedented. Again, this happens almost any time that anybody raises a question, anybody within the executive branch raises a question about the need to investigate something done by somebody else in the executive branch. Because after all, the principal investigators there are Justice Department lawyers, and they're overseen by the Attorney General. So this is itself not terribly unusual, which is also why your point at the beginning about the person for whom the Attorney General works is a question.
Right.
Every Attorney General sees himself or herself is not just working for the President, but ultimately for the Constitution and for the rule of law. I don't think this Attorney General is any different, but there's a question about how they can maintain a balance between their need to maintain the confidence of the President and also their integrity as somebody who oversees a department whose principal duty is to enforce the law.
I don't want to get too crazy here, but is there a jail in Congress?
There is.
There is.
It's almost never used. and you'd have to get marshals, in fact, to bring people over to sit in it.
Really?
But I don't think that's something yet the Attorney General quite has to worry about.
And that's Michael Gerhardt. He's the Samuel Ash Distinguished Professor in Constitutional Law, also Director of the Center for Law and Government at the University of North Carolina Law School. And we asked him to join us today on Radio Times to help us understand not just Fast and Furious, but this looks like a showdown between the House, a committee of the House of Representatives that voted to hold Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. And, of course, President Obama invoking executive privilege for the first time last week. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Even going back to this particular kind of showdown, and if Congress is one of Congress's prime responsibilities is oversight, are they entitled to anything that they ask for? I mean, obviously not. But if you're going to do oversight, sometimes you don't know what you don't know. To quote, you know, Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, you're exactly right. So, in the way we try to analyze that is along two lines. So, the first thing is, if it's just a fishing expedition, if they're just looking for documents and just sort of throwing out broad requests for documents, that's their weakest position. And in that position, the president has considerably probably more leverage and a better argument to maintain confidentiality generally for the information that's generated on his behalf, but also specifically to protect certain operations within the executive branch, particularly within the White House, and to protect the president's need to get the most candid advice and communication so that he can discharge his own constitutional duties. That's one line of analysis. But the other line of analysis is if the committee has a particular idea of the document or documents that they want, that increases their bargaining position. If they've got specific documents they're concerned about and they know they're out there, they know they exist, mm-hmm. And they can't get them, that's a slightly different situation. And the more specific the committee can be, the better off they will be in their own bargaining to try and get this information.
Now, Eric Holder said that the documents requested relate to criminal investigations and prosecutions, and if he were to hand them over, those efforts would be compromised. Is he on sturdy legal ground there?
He could be. And so the concern is not just about fair trial. Concern about it has to do with the prejudicial extent of the extent to which particular information might prejudice perceptions about the investigations. There's also information, for example, about just the Fast and Furious itself. Mm-hmm. So were there what we sometimes call sort of snitches, you know, government informers out there? Is their identity a critical concern here? So drawing the curtain back on a criminal investigation can be a very delicate thing because sometimes it even involves innocent people. You investigate some folks but decide there's no criminal misconduct there. You start looking at other people. But if you start drawing the curtain back and get information about criminal investigations, that can sweep along with it all sorts of reputations that might not actually be justifiably at risk here. So the Attorney General does have a reason to be concerned about who's innocent and perhaps who's not, and to try and maintain a line between the guilty and the innocent so that the committee doesn't overreach and besmirch people that are just not, in the Attorney General's opinion, guilty of any misconduct here.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about executive privilege. When was the first time that was invoked? But my understanding is it's not written specifically in the U.S. Constitution.
Right. The United States Constitution says there is no specific provision granting the president the entitlement to what is called an executive privilege. But every president, including George Washington, has maintained their need to maintain the confidentiality information generated on their behalf. And they call this executive privilege. So every president has argued that he's entitled to it. And I think almost every constitutional scholar in the country concedes that a president would be entitled to this notion of executive privilege. So that's not much in dispute. The critical question has to do with a specific case, in which case is a president entitled to have particular information maintained as confidential and under his complete control? That's what we're disputing over here.
Well, which of course raises questions about, for instance, Watergate, when there are
right.
crimes being committed running through the White House. Obviously, Congress has the right to that information, but
right.
but if someone invokes or Nixon invokes executive privilege, where does it leave them?
Well, in Watergate, it didn't help them. So in Watergate, the information ultimately was reviewed in camera or means privately by a judge. He decided what could be used and what couldn't be used. Most of it could be used. And oftentimes that is one way that these disputes get resolved, which is you find some third party like a judge or a neutral arbiter or somebody else at the branches or others trust. They could look at the information. Here, I think what's going to happen is less likely bringing in a third party, but they just try and find some point that they can agree on, and they'll just go over document by document what could be disclosed and what can't be. But the Attorney General would need to specify why particularly this particular information or portion of a document can't be disclosed.
We're almost up on the end of the show here, but how significant is this quote-unquote showdown?
It is very significant on a couple different levels. One is just the constitutional level. So we're looking at how constitutional conflicts that occur outside the courts typically get handled. They're high-stakes games, but they're also situations in which the branches have to understand the scope of their respective powers and where they can reach accommodation and where they need to each draw a line. That's one level. But the other thing we can't forget is this is an election year, and so raising the drama of it serves some political purpose for Republicans, and they have very little incentive, I suppose, to reach compromises because they can see a political advantage to push against the president. On the other hand, the president may see a political advantage in pushing back against them.
Well, on that note, Michael Gerhardt, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's the Samuel Ash Distinguished Professor in Constitutional Law, Director of the Center for Law and Government at the University of North Carolina Law School. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.